Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
For members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the rituals at their temples are kind of this peak experience. It's quite different from what happens at the Ward House on Sunday. The historian Jonathan Stapley says, what happens in the temple is this ordered set of rites. People go through washing and anointing, and then it opens up into this staged, symbolic story. It's kind of like a play where the drama depicts humanity's journey and its relationship to God, and worshipers learn these lessons about divine law and the importance of making covenants with God. And Stapley says the temple is critical to the Mormon experience. But the truth is, because the temple is considered sacred and deeply private, and because the ceremony is meticulous and highly structured and stylized, it can seem mysterious or even kind of confusing to some. Stapley says this is how President Brigham Young felt in the early days of the church.
After Joseph Smith is murdered in 1844, Brigham Young and the Quorum of the Twelve lead the Latter-day Saints to build and finish the temple in Nauvoo. And they work furiously to do so. Once the temple's complete in a couple of years, they bring thousands of members through. Whereas just a handful of people experience the temple during Joseph Smith's life, literally thousands are taken through the temple and receive the temple ceremonies there. And then they immediately leave under threat of violence. And at that point, the Latter-day Saints are refugees. They make their way to Omaha Nation territory, and they build what's called Winter Quarters, a temporary city. And Brigham Young, at this time, his family is expanding in kind of radical ways. He's a polygamist. He has other church members that are adopted to him in the temple, and he's ill, confined to his bed, teetering in and out of consciousness. And he has what he writes and narrates as a vision. Joseph Smith, who is dead, appears to him and then introduces to him kind of a cosmic vision of the whole of things. But before he does, Brigham Young confesses. He says, look, I'm not sure I understand what we are doing in the temple. He knows the kind of scriptural basis for the ceremonies, but he confesses that he doesn't fully get it, which is pretty remarkable considering how hard they work to finish it and then bring all the saints through. But the way he describes it is he has a vision and he sees how humanity is supposed to be stitched together in this great network that he calls the priesthood, and that the ceremonies of the temple were a way to connect humanity in that way. It's one of the few documents that he takes the time to handwrite himself instead of dictating to somebody else. This is a key moment in his development as a prophet to the saints. I think it's tremendously important because at that time, we have all these sort of weird relationships that kind of make church members today uncomfortable. Plural marriage. We're sealing families in non-biological ways together in parent-child relationships. And for many people, it's sort of a mystery as to why. And for Brigham Young in that moment, he sees that it's about connecting not just his small community there on the frontiers of America, but it's about connecting the entire human family together. And it's that precise vision that helps us analyze and understand some of the more peculiar things that happen in subsequent decades, whether it's racial restrictions surrounding the temple, whether it's shifts in marriage sealing practice. This idea of a connected network is at the core of what Latter-day Saints are trying to do.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the LDS temple experience. Jonathan Stapley has a new book coming out next month called Holiness to the Lord, where he traces the origins of the temple practice. He explores how church founder Joseph Smith developed it and how it evolved over time. And that idea of change is really important to the story. Stapley also writes about how the temple shaped the faith and gave it a sense of cosmic identity, is how he puts it. He also explores the privacy, or as some might see it, the secrecy in the temple experience. Stapley is an independent scholar, and he's an active Latter-day Saint. So he knows from personal experience that while the temple is foundational to the religion, it's also so private and so highly protected that it can come across as a little disorienting, even for believers.
Like most Latter-day Saints, particularly of my age, I was a teenager in the 1990s, we had very little by way of context or interpretation to help us experience and make sense of the temple. And so for me, I largely just trusted that the people around me were having good experiences in the temple and that over time it would make sense to me. And then I've been a historian. I'm working in researching in Latter-day Saint history for over two decades. That labor has really helped to, for me, enrich my own experience because I can supply the context and the why of what I experienced there as a church member.
Do you mind saying what you experienced when you first went through the temple for the first time? One of the things you mention in the book is that because there wasn't a lot of talk about what goes on in there, the sense of it being the sacred and deeply private, other people might use the word secrecy. But young Latter-day Saints who go through it for the first experience, for the first time, not really knowing what quite to expect, are kind of disoriented by the experience.
Yeah, it can be disorienting. It can give a sense of vertigo because it's difficult to situate yourself when you're doing something that's unfamiliar. So Latter-day Saints experience weekly worship services that are patterned after kind of low church Protestant worship. We have sermons and the Lord's Supper and extemporaneous prayers.
But not a lot of really rote ritual going on.
Yeah, there's very little formalized scripted ritual, whereas the temple is highly scripted. And if you've never experienced something like that before, it's easy to feel disoriented.
Yeah.
And for me, and I can contrast my experience perhaps with my mom's. So my mom grew up in Ephraim, Utah. I grew up in Seattle. And
so she went to the Manti Temple.
Manti Temple, yeah. As did I.
Huh.
So I went to the family temple, if you will.
Right.
My mom, however, her family wasn't entirely practicing, and so she went largely alone. Her mom didn't have a temple recommend, and it was difficult, that transition. Mm-hmm. For me, I had a number of siblings, extended family that all showed up to the temple, and I think having that sort of extended family support helped buffer the disorientation because it seemed like, okay, I didn't particularly understand what was happening. I didn't really have much preparation, but these people that I trusted were around me, and so I was willing to give the time to let it make sense.
I think outsiders hearing this might say, does he mean it can seem weird?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize that this happens, you know, across religions. So if you are not Catholic and you show up to Mass for the to visit a friend, to experience the confirmation of your friend's children, it's disorienting.
Yeah.
You don't know when to stand
when do I
or
kneel?
Sit.
Right.
You don't know when to call and respond.
Yeah.
And that's disorienting.
Yeah.
Even the names we use for things. So we talk about the temple where we go to be endowed or have initiatory ceremonies or sealings. Those terms don't have a meaning, a lexical value outside of the tradition. Similar to when if you tell a non-Christian that you have the Eucharist, that is a term that's unfamiliar.
Yeah.
And so there isn't a lot of support in making those translations within the tradition and particularly outside of the tradition.
I wonder, does it – part of that disorientation, is it difficult also that you're not – and we'll get into the particulars of the sort of privacy part in a minute. But is part of that difficulty that you can't really outside of the bounds of the temple ask too many questions about some of the particulars of the experience? You can't really talk about it, or not supposed to anyway.
Yeah. So it's worth just noting from the outset that there is a long history of privacy or secrecy surrounding the temple.
Yeah.
And to be clear, as part of the temple ceremonies, Latter-day Saints promise to keep certain elements of the temple isolated to the temple. But in reality, it's a very small and some might even say an insignificant portion of the overall temple experience. But particularly in the 20th century, church leaders encouraged and directed church members to limit their discourse surrounding the temple and basically to isolate any discussion of what happens to the temple to inside the temple. And it created kind of an explicative vacuum.
Yeah.
The Latter-day Saints were not able to communicate the details of what happened in the temple to outsiders and even to their own children and converts in some cases.
How do you then explain, I guess I'll put it this way, the dilemma you might face as an active Latter-day Saint who respects that expectation of privacy, who finds the experience of going to a temple, you know, personally and spiritually meaningful, and yet as a scholar trying to offer some kind of objective perspective and objective analysis of the temple experience in a book?
Right. It is not obvious, I think, but there's a couple things that are important. First, we live in a day now where the church itself has shifted how it has talking about the temple and has opened up ways of talking about that temple that it previously were inaccessible. So, for example, Latter-day Saints make promises in the temple to live a righteous life, and they make several specific promises to do that. And when I was a child, the church explicitly told their members not to mention those specific promises outside of the temple.
Yeah.
You couldn't list them.
Right.
Whereas the church publishes them now for everybody to see. I think it's also important to note that because the temple is such a central feature of Latter-day Saint lived religion and theology, that it necessarily is manifested in the way Latter-day Saints talk about life and religion generally. So Latter-day Saint records are replete with reflections on temple experience and its meaning. And for the last several decades, the Church History Library in Salt Lake City has been digitizing tens of millions of documents. And Latter-day Saints regularly talk about their experiences. Now, they sometimes redact material that they believe is too sensitive, but for the most part, it's not difficult to take this information and synthesize the context and try to represent the experiences and meanings that the temple has offered Latter-day Saints through time. So, yes, we must be sensitive, I think, as scholars, but we can also be faithful to the experiences of Latter-day Saints themselves, including the church leaders who experience the temple, and really offer something that's clear while respectful. Perhaps in my book I'm threading a difficult needle,
yeah,
but I think we can do that successfully.
You write this in the book: if you are seeking secret knowledge, then I'm afraid this book will be of little help to you. Let me break that down as a sentence. Like, what do you mean if they're seeking secret knowledge? Because this is one of the things you do mention, that really from the beginning, the beginning of the Mormon experience in the 1840s, as soon as Joseph Smith had established, you know, sort of temple rituals, that people were trying to figure out the secrets. How do you understand that, what people are looking for? There's a kind of expose factor that mm-hmm. there's something weird or strange, or like, how do you understand that?
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to that question. First, I've heard many Latter-day Saints talk about how they have gone to the temple for decades and are just now beginning to understand its meaning. And that's sort of a mystical experience. And scholars, there's a scholar, Hugh Urban, who has written about secrecy, particularly religious secrecy, and he's urged scholars to basically saying that those sort of mystical experiences are non-communicable.
Mm.
We can't access this meaning to this person, but what we can focus on is the way knowledge is transferred between people and the way institutions govern and sort of negotiate the boundaries of privacy and secrecy.
I guess we should, to be fair, though, also, or at least to be transparent, a lot of what people are looking for in terms of what they're hoping you will reveal as the secrets or the secret knowledge is imagery or language that is violent, that is sexist, that is potentially racist, potentially, you know, traumatic or harmful. So it's – those things do come up as well in this conversation. We should just – point out.
Yeah, there are elements of the liturgy as it has changed over the time, over the decades, that people have found problematic. And it's worth noting that perhaps expose is a feature of modern society. People distrust institutions, and we want everything to be 100% transparent. Mm. And if we can't see something, then we're incredulous.
It can't be good.
Yeah, it can't.
This is how you put it in the book. You said scholars, media, and other observers often have to choose between silence and expose.
Yeah, that has been the choice for decades,
yeah.
For centuries, really. And it's worth noting that the people that are providing exposés have often had experiences that are real, but also flavor and bias their experience, just as the religious faithful Latter-day Saints have experiences that flavor and bias their narration of the temple.
You write in the book that the first attempts to reveal the privacy, the secrecy, whatever, those first attempts were published during Joseph Smith's life in the 1840s. So this has always been the case, I guess.
Yeah, there has been a steady procession of pamphlets, books, and then with the advent of different technologies, audio and video technology that allow access of aspects of the temple to the gaze of the public.
Mm.
But oftentimes these exposés are distortions and are perceived as almost violent by church members. They are blasphemous, and any sort of religious exposé, whether it's about Catholics in early American history or Mormons in the 20th and 21st centuries, they're authored with intent,
yeah.
Typically. It's rarely journalistic in nature. And particularly when those expose accounts are amplified in popular media or entertainment, it is wildly disconcerting to church members who cherish these elements of their religion as holy and sacred.
Jonathan Stapley. His new book is called Holiness to the Lord, Latter-day Saint Temple Worship. It comes out next month. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Jonathan Stapley about his forthcoming book on the Mormon temple practice. Stapley says temples give Latter-day Saints a cosmic identity. It's a place where they order their bodies, their communities, their universe. In the book, he traces how the temple rites emerged and how they shaped a sense of belonging. He also talks about privacy and secrecy in temples in the age of the internet. His book is called Holiness to the Lord. Let's get to the idea you're getting at in the book. One of the things you mention is that you're concerned about the work the temple has done in the lives and minds of its patrons and the relationships that it has created. What do you mean by that? What are you getting at there?
Well, so the temple ceremonies and the cosmology that it manifests and reifies in the lives of Latter-day Saints orders the Latter-day Saint experience in their families and in relation to those outside of our faith. It regulates Latter-day Saint foodways. It regulates how
What do you mean by that?
What we eat and drink.
The temple regulates what you eat and drink.
Yeah. So my grandma drank coffee most of her life and didn't have a temple recommend because of that.
But they ordered their lives based on their ability to stay worthy enough to get into the temple, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Latter-day Saints, after they go to the temple, they wear religious underclothing
right. That
affects the choices they make about the clothes they wear. It affects who they date and who they marry. I mean, these are the biggest choices a human can make in their life.
Is this what you mean when you say that it's a space where Latter-day Saints create a cosmic identity? Is that what you mean by
Absolutely.
That?
Yeah. Well, and I mean, so cosmology is a difficult word for some people because we, in the modern era, we think of astrophysics.
Right.
But
you're just thinking of the order of things.
Yeah. Scholars often focus on religious cosmology
yeah. And
the stories we tell about where humanity fits in the universe and its humanity's relationship to God. And the temple for Latter-day Saints is a place where those ideas are made concrete.
Hmm. When does Joseph Smith – I'll put it this way I think people hearing this question are going to think I'm implying that Joseph Smith just sort of invented it, and some think he did, some think he didn't. But when did Joseph Smith get this idea for a temple ritual?
Hmm. So I think it's quite clear that there is no single moment where the temple ceremonies as Latter-day Saints experience it today came fully emerged to Joseph Smith. What we see is that from the beginning – elements of the temple liturgy were revealed by Joseph Smith to the Latter-day Saints. So before the church is even a year old, Joseph Smith dictates a revelation where God gives an expectation that all the church members in New York are to move to Ohio. And he says, "There you will be endowed with power from on high." And with time and over successive iterations of Joseph Smith's revelation, we begin a process of ritualization where Joseph Smith reveals ceremonies that are expanded and systematized that then give Latter-day Saints an experience of an endowment in the temple.
What would those early ceremonies have been like? One of the points you make clear in the book, and we'll talk about this, is that the ceremony evolved, the ritual, the liturgy evolved. So in those very earliest days, let's talk about what it was like. One of the things that I keyed in on is that participants would wash themselves in clean water and then they would apply this like scented alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things. You also mentioned how one of the things that they would do is they would And this sort of evokes Jesus from the New Testament, they would wash each other's feet.
Yeah.
It was part of the process. So what was it like? It seemed – it didn't have the sort of structure, obviously, of the ceremony or ritual today. It seemed like this kind of communal thing was going on then in the early days.
Is yeah. Right? So in the first year, Joseph Smith introduces some of these ideas. Hey, we're going to be endowed with power from on high. And we need to be declared clean from the blood and sins of this generation. And then within a few years, he receives revelations that, look, we need to do this in the house of the Lord. And so they construct a temple in Kirtland, but it's not a temple like Latter-day Saints have today and that we're familiar with. It's not a place that is private. They hold regular meetings and meals and wedding ceremonies in there. And what Joseph Smith introduces at that time is, as you say, a suite of ceremonies where they are self-consciously repeating the consecration rituals of the Hebrew Bible. Hmm. So in the New Testament, there's a lot of talk about elders of the church being ordained, and Christian churches often follow that process today, typically with the laying on of hands. In the Hebrew Bible, the priests at the temple were created by consecration. They were washed. They were anointed. They were dressed in priestly clothing that was specific to their stations at the temple. They sacrificed. And in Kirtland, Joseph Smith introduces this consecration ceremony where the priesthood officers in the church, they washed themselves, they anointed each other, they washed each other's feet. And they begin to, again, self-consciously materialize some of these ideas.
We should also mention that early it was limited to not all saints and always men, at least initially. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was limited to priesthood officers in the church. And today, virtually every Latter-day Saint male over the age of 12 is ordained to a priesthood office. That was not the case in these early years. Priesthood office, deacon, teacher, priest, elder, 70 apostle, those were all inhabited by adult men. And so it was a fraction of the religious population. And there is some retrospective accounts where women were, quote, downright huffy, that they didn't get to experience it. And, you know, understandably so.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in Nauvoo where this is expanded to both men and women and becomes an expectation for basically all practicing Latter-day Saints.
That's when the I suppose the sort of liturgy, the temple ceremony that people are familiar with, although it's changed now, that's when that sort of comes about, is in Nauvoo. Let me ask you before we get to Nauvoo, though. Does Joseph Smith say he has in mind an evolution of this process? Does he say, first we're going to start with some washing and anointing, and we're going to do some washing of the feet, and that's it. This is this, or let's try this, and I'm going to keep working this thing out. We're going to eventually. Does he ever say that?
No, I mean every scholar wishes there was such a thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where people self-consciously reflect on what they're doing, but instead, what we have, particularly in Kirtland, we have just this rich body of accounts where people kept diaries. We have minutes, and we have dozens of people's experiences narrating how they participated in the ceremonies and what happened after. And then we have to go back and try to reconstruct what they mean, because they're not doing that heavy lifting for us.
Yeah. When does all of this start to become private? I'll put it secret. You say these the revelations that start to change in Nauvoo. This is where they're nested. This is how you put it in the book. We're nested within new constraints about privacy and secrecy. So let's talk about the evolution of this kind of privacy and secrecy. And we have to talk about what happens in March of 1842, because this seems like an important moment. Joseph Smith, you write about, is talking to the women of the Relief Society. And he says that he's going to deliver to them the keys of the kingdom. Would you take us through this experience? Because a few days later, he offers this sermon that involves keys and signs that are now going to be part of this temple experience. So would you talk about this moment in time?
Yeah. So I think that it's important to note that in Nauvoo, the saints have just recovered from the Missouri-Mormon War, where they were violently expelled. Some saints were murdered, raped. And there is a significant trauma from that experience.
That's important context for all of
us. That's an important context. And Joseph Smith is introducing the practice of polygamy or plural marriage. And he's keeping it on the down low. And so those two elements are at play. And there is a new sense of sacred, of holy. And there are traditions in the Hebrew Bible and early Christianity where there is a sense that we need to protect what's holy and not disclose it broadly. Mm. So with that, Joseph Smith in 1842 is initiated into Freemasonry. And I think there's a caricature of Freemasons that they're masters of international affairs and controlling world dynamics. And
it's like Dan Brown stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, they are a fraternity and they do their thing.
Right. And Joseph Smith wants to be part of it because it's a social fraternity.
And he clearly experiences something that sparks his religious imagination. So in Freemasonry, when you are initiated, you experience what's called a dramatic liturgy.
Yeah.
Members participate in the retelling of a story about a character named Hiram Abiff, who is a conglomeration of several biblical narrative characters, who is overseeing the construction of the Solomon's Temple. He's murdered. It's sort of a tragic tale. He is murdered because he won't tell the key secrets of Masonry. And as part of the ceremony, Masons engage in various ritual practices, including hand clasps and clothing that is representative of the narrative.
Keywords.
Keywords. They make promises and oaths, particularly to keep things secret. And in response for breaking, they take upon transgressing this secrecy, they take upon themselves kind of representations of violent penalties in response that result in that they will die in violent ways if they divulge these secrets.
Right.
Joseph Smith, after experiencing Freemasonry in early 1842, he's been saying that for a while that, again, he's been saying for over a decade that the saints need to be endowed with power from on high. And in the months after experiencing Freemasonry, he uses the methods of ritual presentation that he found in Masonry to present what Latter-day Saints call the plan of salvation, the story of creation, the Adam and Eve and the progression back to God, and to present the endowment. In doing so, he retains some of the fixtures of Freemasonry. So there are elements of teaching, the hand clasps. There is still the oaths of secrecy and the penalties that are retained.
That all comes from Freemasonry.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's interesting. Like you do hear, I suppose it's a critique or the idea that Joseph Smith wasn't just using the ceremony of Freemasonry as loose context for the Mormon temple ceremony, but verbatim, a lot of the key elements of it were taken directly from Freemasonry. You say it was distinct. But how is it distinct?
Well, it's – I think scholars of religion and ritual focus on like what work is it doing, right? Mm. And the work of the Latter-day Saint Temple, the endowment ceremony, is the construction of this heavenly priesthood, the kings and queens, priests and priestesses. It's this heavenly vision of Christian cosmology, the creation – of the world situated.
This is the Mormon version you're saying.
Yeah.
And whereas the Freemason version is secular.
Well, it's not even the same story.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it's useful. Ritual theorists talk about social technology, ritual as social technology. And I think it's useful to think about dramatic liturgy in that way. Joseph Smith founded Masonry, a technology to present the religious experiences for the saints that he'd been working on for over a decade.
One of the things that the part that I think is seems to be disorienting, to have been disorienting for Latter-day Saints in the experience, were where participants make these promises of secrecy with these violent penalties associated with it. That doesn't happen anymore.
That's right.
Why did they change that?
Nothing could prepare a modern Latter-day Saint to experience violent penalties in the temple. And it was disturbing to many people. Mm-hmm. I think it was disturbing to church leaders. And so as they evaluated the content of the endowment ceremonies, they concluded that they were justified in removing it. And that sort of analysis has always happened with regard to the temple ceremonies. Throughout the decades, church leaders have been willing to critically evaluate the content and form of the temple ceremonies and make adjustments that they deem are appropriate.
Jonathan Stapley. His book is called Holiness to the Lord, Latter-day Saint Temple Worship. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Jonathan Stapley. We're talking about his new book about the origin and evolution of the LDS temple ritual. The book comes out next month. It's called Holiness to the Lord. What happens to the temple liturgy and the direction of the temple ceremony after Joseph Smith is killed?
Kind of the first and most obvious thing is that Joseph Smith performs the temple ceremonies on an ad hoc basis in various non-temple locations while he's alive. Once the temple's complete—
There's a space now.
That we have a location.
Yeah.
And part of that is systematizing the ceremonies. We know that, for example, the Quorum of the Twelve and Brigham Young are in charge of the temple, and they start adding characters to the story.
Huh.
So in the endowment liturgy, there are heavenly messengers, Peter, James, and John, and they we have the day when Brigham Young adds them to the ceremony.
So that wasn't a Joseph Smith thing. So they're adding stuff.
Yeah, for
they
sure.
They feel like we can— this wasn't just Joseph's idea. We can, yeah.
We can tell the story.
Huh.
We can change the liturgy to make it more systematic. They talk about working on temple clothing, those robes that I talked about during the ceremonies, and the undergarment, religious undergarment that they wear, and making sure they're uniform because there's all different sorts of patterns. And so there's an effort to take these ceremonies that were offered to several dozen people during Joseph Smith's life and then administer it to literally thousands in Nauvoo. And that requires, I don't want to say industrialization because that happens later, but an effort to systematically offer these ceremonies on a repeat basis to hundreds every day.
One of the things you mentioned they changed once Brigham Young became president of the church is they shortened the ceremony by several— – this must have been a long, very long ceremony at some point, mm-hmm. and they shortened it, you mentioned. But you also say they ended the practice of— – I'll just read from the book. They ended the practice of praying for God's vengeance upon those who had murdered the prophets. By that, they mean Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram Smith. So for a while, it included— – a prayer for vengeance. It's kind of an intense prayer for vengeance for a while, I suppose.
Yeah. So what we have is on the year anniversary after Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith are murdered, we have members of the Temple Quorum, this group of people that have experienced the temple ceremonies, they gather for a temple prayer. And this is something that they do fairly regularly. Mm. But on that day in particular, they offer as part of their prayer an allusion to the Book of Revelation. So in the Book of Revelation, it talks about the blood of the martyrs going up to God, asking for when they will be avenged. Hmm. And so they incorporate that language into their prayer. And it appears that these people who knew and loved Joseph and Hiram, that experienced the violence of Nauvoo, incorporated that into the liturgy.
Interesting.
And that endured until the early 20th century.
Wow. So the liturgy changes. That seems to be a consistent theme here, is it changed and changed based on some of the things we were talking about. And the question is that you get at in the book is how it is that Latter-day Saints took that idea of change. You tell this story of Rosie McGee, this woman named Rosie McGee. I guess, if I understand the story right, she stands up in her LDS ward. She's in California, somewhere in California, and she decries the fact that they've changed the liturgy. She even goes out and prints pamphlets or something. But tell us about her and what this says about the way some members deal with the idea of this sort of evolution of the temple ceremony.
Yeah, she publishes a pamphlet that says Heber J. Grant, who's the president of the church,
right,
drove a knife in the back of Mormonism. Yeah. With the changes to the temple and the garment. And I think that this really encapsulates some experiences that Latter-day Saints have in negotiating change. And there are some scholars, a scholar Steve Taysom, who's talked about this really well, that Christian, Western religions, Christian religions that stay relevant, that stay historically persistent, which is a fancy way of saying they stick around, do so by changing, but also simultaneously giving a sense that things don't change. Because God is unchanging,
yeah,
and you want to connect to this sort of timelessness of religion. But we all know that church is different than it was for our grandparents and then their grandparents, right? So this case, I think, is extremely irrelevant because one of the things that was so shocking to this woman was the fact that they shortened the garments. So garments are the religious underwear that Latter-day Saints wear.
Yeah.
And throughout the 19th century, they went to your ankle and to your wrists. So they were kind of like long underwear.
Sure.
And in the early 1920s, they shortened them to the knee and elbow. And for some people, that was great. You know, there was no problem.
Because it's July and I've got work in the field and this thing's hot.
That's right.
Yeah.
This is hot. But some people, like Sister McGee,
yep,
that change struck at the heart of something that she wasn't willing to budge on. Hmm. And so it was a faith crisis for her. And I think we see some of that today. So in the last year,
yeah,
the church announced that garments were going to go somewhat sleeveless in some cases. And
this was deeply meaningful for Latter-day Saint women.
Yeah.
It's like all over – go to social media. And
all over
social media.
The conversation
is incredible.
And for some women, this was a huge relief. It was a wonderful change.
Yeah.
But there are also women who had negotiated church standards of quote-unquote modesty and had made sacrifices and changed their behavior and consequently questioned with this change whether or not their own sacrifices were then necessary or valid. Mm. And so anytime religions do change, whether it's going to non-Latin mass among the Roman Catholics or changing the length of the sleeve of your religious underwear, there are church members who find change exultant and wonderful and church members who find it disorienting.
You write that the church is still in some ways kind of figuring out how to talk about all of this with the public, that it used to be a time when they were deeply protective of the sort of the privacy elements. There was a sense of secrecy to it. Now, as you said, they're publishing certain elements of it. It's more accessible in some ways. Still deeply private, but the church is still negotiating how to talk about this with the public. What do you see in that now?
So I think that the internet changed everything.
Yeah.
Mm. The church could more easily kind of control the message before the advent of the internet. And it was easy to cast the expose or the critic as other and outside of the perception of the day-to-day member.
Yeah.
Today, that's just no longer possible. I have a friend who has a high schooler here in Salt Lake, and the high schooler came home as a junior or senior in high school, and the temple ceremony on YouTube was circulating among his friends. He had watched it, and he came to his parents and were like, what is this?
Yeah.
So the internet has mediated expose and information in ways that the church is reacting to, I think. And what that means is that there's been an increase in disclosure. Every new temple that is dedicated.
President Nelson likes to build temples.
He likes to build them. And he has the budget to do so now.
Right, right.
When I was a kid, the church did not have the budget for that.
Yeah.
And so there's an increase in visibility of the temple. There's an increase in accessibility to unfiltered and often uncritical information about the temple. And so we have an effort to hopefully better contextualize and narrate and elucidate the experience for Latter-day Saints. We talked about earlier how they've disclosed the promises you make in the temple. And I think more and more the church is willing to talk about the work of the temple.
Do you think Joseph Smith, did he envision the current state of temple? Would he have been taken aback about the way the temple plays out in Latter-day Saint life today, do you think, in any way? I mean, it's a counterfactual. Who knows?
Yeah, but who knows? But I mean, I think he would have been enthralled with the technology of the temple, right? I think that he is quoted as saying that temples would be ubiquitous. And so I think he would find gratification in that. Certainly, he would be dumbfounded by many elements of Latter-day Saint lived religion.
Let me ask you finally, one of the things we talked about early on was just how the Mormon experience in the temple gave Latter-day Saints a cosmic identity. It ordered everything about the way they negotiate the world in some ways. But I wonder, the idea of having a temple recommend is different from going to the temple.
Hmm.
So do mainstream Latter-day Saints, and let me just apply this to a younger generation, millennials and younger, do they experience the temple? Do they go to the temple, as far as you know, in the same numbers as older generations? Is that changing, do you think?
I would love to have the data on that. Hmm. But my impulse as a historian is to go to what I do know. So what I know is that we often think in terms of linear narratives. But at the beginning of the 20th century, the average ward attendance in sacrament meeting on the Wasatch Front was about 15%. Hmm. Less than 40% of all marriages in the stakes of Zion, if you will, in
the Intermountain West.
In the Intermountain West were temple marriages. And what we see is that throughout the 20th century, there is a steady increase in practicing among church members. They increase in their attendance. They increase in their temple attendance. And I think there were some sociologists who extrapolated from that and thought maybe, you know, those linear trends would continue indefinitely, and they didn't. I suspect that rates of adherence, intergenerational adherence, and rates of temple recommend holding are probably down from when I was a teenager in the 1990s. But I also suspect that that will never be static. that the new challenges that face the church are always an opportunity for change and growth.
Yeah.
And I suspect that church members will find new ways to make meaning in the temple. It's clear that church leaders today are doubling down on church practice. With regard to the temple, they're building hundreds of temples throughout the world. Mm. And consequently, it's more so than when I was a kid, becoming the way of being a Latter-day Saint.
Jonathan Stapley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Stapley, his new book is called Holiness to the Lord, Latter-day Saint Temple Worship. It comes out next month. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.